1230 AM, W255DN Wausau. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Allison Keyes. A Southwest Airlines flight dropped some 300 feet in 36 seconds as pilots maneuvered to avoid another aircraft. And lucky passengers thanked the pilot when it landed. CBS's Chris Van Cleve with more.
The pilots received two alerts from the onboard collision avoidance system calling for immediate evasive maneuvers to avoid a potential collision with a 66-year-old former Swiss Air Force fighter jet that was descending nearby at more than 500 miles an hour.
This big free fall feeling.
It just felt like you were on like a free fall roller coaster.
The Southwest Boeing 737 first climbed, then rapidly descended about 475 feet before climbing about 600 feet.
President Trump is in Scotland for golf and trade talks, but CBS's Christian Benavides reports he's still facing controversy.
The trip comes as here at home, Trump continues to face questions about Jeffrey Epstein. In Florida, Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, a former Trump criminal defense lawyer, has now conducted two closed-door meetings with Epstein's co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell, in an effort to quiet criticisms the administration is blocking access to the Epstein files. Maxwell is serving a 20-year prison term.
Some 100 million in the nation are bracing for high heat and stormy weather. CBS News meteorologist Jeff Ray.
The humidity tomorrow, I promise you're going to notice, it's going to be ridiculous across the afternoon. We're going to have a lot of tropical moisture from this system coming up from the Gulf. So here is the afternoon today where we get a few scattered showers, very isolated in nature for the afternoon today. Now they'll quickly dissipate without the daytime heating.
Palestinian health officials say at least 25 were killed overnight, most while waiting for aid. The BBC's Hugo Bishega.
Very limited amount of aid is getting in, and what is there is not reaching everyone. And what aid agencies are saying is that the only way to ease the crisis in Gaza, a worsening humanitarian crisis there, is by allowing the unrestricted entry and distribution of aid in the territory.
NASA is losing 20% of its staff. CBS's Michael Wallace.
That's nearly 4,000 of the space agency's 18,000 employees. The deadline to apply was midnight. A White House budget proposal would slash NASA's funding by about 25%, from $24 billion to $18 billion. NASA says safety remains a top priority as it balances the need to become a more streamlined and efficient organization and works to get astronauts to the moon and Mars.
The workers are leaving under a buyout program introduced by DOGE. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Veterans, have you explored your benefits lately? The Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs stands ready to serve Wisconsin veterans, their families, and their survivors. With our partners like your local county veteran service officer, we can help access the benefits you've earned and the support you need. For more information, please visit wisvets.com. That's wisvets.com. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs, with funding provided by the Milwaukee Brewers and the Brewers Community Foundation.
Again, and again, not new, not surprising, should be of surprise, a shock to no one that this is what they believe. Because, again, he was going to go and he was going to cut all Elon's funding. And, well, no. And understand, the idea that the U.S. does better when billionaires do better, one of the biggest lies that's been sold to us growling blue-collar types. Every year, especially recently, the wealthy keep getting wealthier. Our billionaires keep pocketing more and more, like $2 trillion just in 2024 alone. While millions of us working people, well, we get the benefits of stagnant wages. We get a sky-high cost of living. And really, that idea of work hard, play by the rules, get ahead, no, not really. And the truth is, what makes billionaires richer doesn't trickle down. It just piles up at the top while we fight for the scraps, if there are any. We keep hearing that if billionaires are doing well, the country's doing well. But have you looked around? Has it felt like you in the working class, like us, we in the working class, have done any better? Not really. Jobs have been shipped overseas. Good unions get crushed. Healthcare and housing get much more expensive. And wages, well, stagnant, or in most cases declining as inflation continues to go up. Meanwhile, those who sit in our rarefied air at the very top, they reap untold billions. They inherit fortunes, they game the system, and don't really create the jobs or improve communities as we were sold all of this was going to do. And the real kicker is many billionaires aren't getting rich by building the stuff, again, that they told us they were going to do. They're not helping society. They're getting this wealth the old-fashioned way. Cronyism, monopolies, political favors. They buy influence, buy lawmakers, buy tax breaks, and ultimately buy silence. And that means money that could go to fixing your kid's school, raising our pay, making sure that health care is for everyone, well, it just ends up in the fat cat's pockets. And then, well, they slash all the protections for the rest of us. Look back to that pandemic thing and the post-pandemic year. Billionaires, their wealth shot up through the roof, while millions of people lost their jobs and faced evictions. Their stock portfolios soared. Why? Government bailouts, emergency policies that barely touch the lives of average everyday working people. And the $600, $300 unemployment thing. Did you see them lose their mind over that? And look, they're not sharing the prosperity of this country. This is predatory enrichment. They're making money off your back. Sure, some billionaires can contribute through actual innovation. Sure, a couple. But the data for the last decade tells us that when the billionaires thrive, the working class doesn't. The economic growth goes to them. The political power goes for them. And inequality for us gets worse. The American dream has become almost a punchline, not a promise. Not the promise I grew up believing in. And look, working people aren't dumb. We know this system is rigged in favor of the ultra-wealthy, the connected, the corporate special interests, the lobbyists. We know that. We see how the wealthy hoard power, dodge taxes, and then use their money to silence workers and sideline communities. The U.S. might look like it's doing better on paper when billionaires grow richer, but for you and me, the backbone of this country, not so much. It's a nightmare of lost opportunity, growing debt, and well, sadly, fewer rights. So no, workers don't do better when billionaires do better. The U.S. doesn't do better for the majority when the wealthy and the powerful are able to concentrate wealth into a few hands. The only way forward is breaking that cycle, standing up for workers' rights, fighting for fair wages, public investments, roads, bridges, education. That's the way forward. Now, flip that around. When workers do better, everyone, including billionaires, do better. And it's not just a slogan. It's backed by solid economic data. When wages rise and working conditions improve, workers have more disposable income in their pocket, and they do what? They spend it in local shops and in, well, big corporations. It's a win-win that strengthens our entire economy. But understand, our wealthy, they're lazy. They don't want to do the work of earning your business or providing you a good. No, that's too much like work. That's what you do. And look, we all know that for years, the balance has been tipped against you and me, the working people of this country. Wage growth is way behind productivity growth, meaning that, well, we share in less of what we produce. Corporate profits are through the roof. Billionaires, their wealth is soaring. But what do we get? We get that widening gulf between the haves and the have-nots. We get that growing inequality that hurts economic stability and slows economic growth for all of us, not for them. What we need, stronger labor protections, stronger union rights to help correct the imbalance by giving workers a real shot, a real voice at bargaining for better wages, hours, conditions. Opportunity. security. Yes, unions raise wages, absolutely. But not just for their members, generally for the entire industry and entire communities. That's how we created a middle class. That means healthier consumer spending, better innovation, more sustainable economic growth. It means all of the positives. Billionaires benefit when the economy is strong and stable, too. If you've got a prosperous workforce, it does trickle up. But they got to work for it. So we most certainly need to be strengthening labor rights. It's not anti-business to be pro-labor. It's pro having a stable, fairer economy. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. What do you think? Is it possible for, if the billionaires are doing great, that the country would be doing great? Or do you see it the other way around? When you're doing well, everyone's doing well. When that whole rising tide lifting all boats, not just having the yachts crush us? Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, in today's digital age, organizing is more vital than ever as democracy is facing unprecedented attacks from misinformation to voter suppression and everything in between. And building strong, connected movements, both online and offline, crucial if we're going to defend our rights, reclaim power for we the people, and leave our children something worth inheriting. And here to talk about the work that his organization is doing in bridging that online, offline divide is Deepak Puri. He's the co-founder of the Democracy Labs. You can check out their website at demlabs.org. Deepak, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick.
So let's talk about this, because, you know, everything today seems about it's all online today, or so my kids keep telling me. You're a guy who came out of Silicon Valley. You're the guy who created part of this. What drove you to this mission, to this organization?
So, Rick, I worked in Silicon Valley. We did fine. In 2016, when Trump got elected, my wife and I decided what's happening isn't right. So we decided to create a non-for-profit that we fund ourselves. And the single mission is, how can you use technology and storytelling to help progressive groups? That's what we do. It's all pro bono. And I've been doing it for almost 8 years now.
So give me an example of what it is that you guys do to help organizations come together. What's the mission? I understand you guys do a lot of free, a lot of pro bono kind of, you know, organizing, a lot of trainings, that kind of stuff. Is that what I'm getting?
Correct. But what a lot of people miss is you need to be able to harness people's anger and frustration at how things are happening and drive them to get organized. So, for instance, one of the things we do a lot of is around gun violence, where every time there's a shooting, people get upset. But what we try and do is use things like maps to kind of illustrate to people that, guys, the fact that there are more shootings in your neighborhood isn't a random event. It's because people in power have voted to support the gun lobby. So let's kind of show you what's going on and then you can see what the problem is, and then we connect them to the politicians who voted for the gun lobby, and then how they can get registered to vote and so on and do something about it.
So it's about, you know, again, going back to voting for people. Now, as I understand, again, Democracy Labs emphasizes the importance of free and affordable digital tools for campaigns. Now, these aren't political campaigns. These are organization campaigns, right? So groups out there who are trying to find their issue and get that out, those are the folks you help?
We help both activists, organizers, and political campaigns. Because one thing which you'll agree with, Rick, is that the bad guys have more money, more people, and they're slicker than the good guys. Now, the working people don't have that kind of know-how and that kind of money. So what I try and do is I work with different groups, try and find out what are the problems that they're having, find the best solution, and in 9 times out of 10, we can find a free solution, we help them apply it, and then we kind of share how other people can find the same tools. I'll give you an example. So say, for instance, in Michigan, where you have lead poisoning in a lot of the water pipes. So the local groups were trying to find out, how can we reach these people? How can we go canvas on those doors and find out where people are struggling? And so we found tools for canvassing, targeting, and again, the tools are free, but people don't know about them, and they don't know how to get them, and that's where we come in.
And you know, I come back to this. I'm an old school organizer. I think you knock on doors, you look people in the eye. For me, and this is where I guess I'm just showing my age. You know, maybe I'm turning into a curmudgeon or my grandfather. I don't know. But I seem to think that, you know, the internet has turned into the place where most people are the worst versions of themselves, and you know, looking somebody in the eye and talking to them seems to be, and for me, the best solutions. You guys are trying to clean that up a little bit, right?
Correct. So we work with lots of groups who are involved in canvassing. And say, for instance, right now with this recess coming up, there are a lot of people who are going to be going to town halls and talking to their elected official. How can I help these folks figure out what are the right questions to ask? Or if you're an organizer and you're canvassing folks, you need to know what is the script, what are the pain points. So technology can be a vehicle for good. Now, it's kind of like, you know, Star Wars, where you've got the evil empire and they're using technology in a terrible way. Whether you like it or not, technology is here and it can be used as a force for good. What we try and do without making any money out of it is, guys, you got to fight fire with fire. Let us show you how you can use technology to level the playing field. Because if I'm a bad guy, what I want to do is distract you with gazillion different things, get you enraged, talk about all kinds of irrelevant things while I'm cutting your Medicaid and your healthcare and other stuff. So what we need to do is find ways to counter that message and help the good guys, you know, show what's really important, who the villain is, and how they can fight back.
Now, is there a way for that to happen, given the fact that, you know, look, I look at most people who I interact with on the internet or, you know, through social media, most of it is just, you know, people being rude, people saying the most outrageous things to get attention. Is there a way to use these tools that, because you're the expert in this, that we don't have to delve into that depth of depravity to try and get to people's attention, to try and do the good? Or do you think we have to, you have to play? I've got people who say you got to play in the mud. So is that reality?
No, we don't believe in playing in the mud, but you have to know how the game is being played. I'll give you a short story. So about 3 years ago, during one of the NFL games, this poor player collapsed on the field. He had a stroke. Luckily, within a couple of days, he was fine. But as soon as he had a stroke, some bozo somewhere started spreading this rumor that, hey, he collapsed because he had a COVID vaccination. Utter nonsense. But the point is, when something happens, you need to be able to respond quickly. So for instance, when people, they vote for this bill to cut Medicaid, you have to respond quickly in order to get in on the media cycle. And in order to do that, there's certain approaches And above all, what I think you'd agree with is people are concerned with their family, with their safety, with the kids' education, with their health care, all kinds of basic things. But to the extent that the bad guys can distract you with other kinds of, you know, extraneous issues, which really don't have much to do with your well-being, they succeed. And often people will tune out. So what we try and emphasize and show people that, guys, when something is going on, whether they're cutting your health care or pollution or so on, let's take that issue. And in that moment, here's how you take your message, amplify it, get it out there for free, emphasis being on free, because then you can harness that anger to get people to take an action like registering to vote or organizing or protesting.
Yeah.
That's the game's play.
I always say the wealth class has got all the money, but we've out-procreated them. There are more of us. If we just got our heads out of our, well, you know, out of the dark side of the moon, maybe we would actually get some things that the working class needs, deserves, earns, instead of all legislation seeming to benefit the handful at the expense of the many, which we saw with the one big beautiful nightmare bill that passed. We are literally, you know, the anti-Jesus Robin Hood in reverse bill. So for me, the idea of amplifying good messaging, creating that digital army of people, you know, sharing good, positive stuff is enticing. But I look at the fact that, you know, the Democrats don't, and I know I'm going to get a bunch of emails saying, you're just beating up on poor Democrats. The Democrats haven't seemed to bought into the digital yet, have they?
You know, I've been doing this 8 years, and I agree with you. And I think this is, it's just sad. What happens is there's a certain establishment where they make money by doing things which are profitable for them. And in general, I'm speaking, it's not a universal, but a lot of political consultants make money buying TV ads. And TV ads are not the most effective solutions out there. So when you have a certain group of people who are motivated to keep doing stuff which makes them money, which may or may not help Democrats, it's a curse.
No, but look, you know, is, Deepak, you know, the reality is TV ads, in my view, and again, I'm a guy who's on TV, I think it would be better to take that money and pay people to stand on street corners with sandwich boards. I think that would be much more effective because at least you can get some interaction. Most people today just tune that stuff out.
I totally agree. The TV ads, you might as well just burn your money. But the thing is, there's ways to do it which are better than sandwich boards, but getting in front of people. But where I think what's important is, especially when activists and organizers who have no money, have very little technical skills, and have very little staffing, they need to be able to figure out a way to get heard, to reach more people. And the way I break it down is, for the time, effort, and money that you're spending on something, how many people are you reaching and persuading? And TV ads is probably the worst way to waste your money. And so there's smart ways to do it. And what we try and do on a day in, day out basis, literally twice a day, we write about examples, specific ways to do this. It's on our website. There's about 2,500 case studies. And the big thing here is, it's not about the money. You need to know what technology is available, especially the ones that are free, and how to use it.
Right.
That's what we try and do.
Well, and look, you know, with technology, you know, rapidly, you know, changing, and innovation coming almost daily, how does Democracy Labs balance that rapid technological speed forward with the need to build long-term movements and ensure that we have the digital tools to where we get activists and organizers together, even with people like me who may not be, well, the most tech savvy?
So the way we work is, number one, we do not sell any software. So that, you know, gives us the flexibility. When a better tool comes out, we'll use that one and recommend that instead. The other thing is, what I believe, my background is over 25 years in Silicon Valley. We'll work with activists. They'll say, how do we canvas better? How do we spread our message? How do we counter this disinformation? So the requests come in to us. We find the best solution available. We'll help them pro bono apply it. and then we share it on our website.
So in your view, Deepak, you know, what are the best issues for your model? Or are all issues the best issues? Are there some that resonate better? Any thoughts?
The issues that we believe are the most important are the like related to fundamental issues, healthcare, education, women's rights, gun violence. But here's the important thing, Rick, which is an issue, and this is part of the strategy of the bad guys. They want to distract you every 6 hours. There's some other news cycle going on, and they want, oh, watch this or watch that. What we try and do is say, guys, when the news is breaking, when they pass this big, ugly bill, let's kind of point out how it impacts you. Show people how it impacts their community, their families, and in that heat of the moment, drive them to take an action that volunteer with this group, go register here, and so on. The speed is essential to a, you know, a good response. That's how you kind of get some traction.
So how do you get, you know, people like me involved? Is this, I guess what I'm trying to get to is, how do we get people activated in this who may not be the most tech savvy? What are we growing new organizers? Is this solely about, we're going to go to an organization, we're going to show you the tools, and you're going to go out and get your activists, your organizers, your foot soldiers? How does this work for folks who are out there paying attention?
So all of us have certain issues that we believe strongly in. It might be women's rights or like the right to reproductive health. Whatever your issue is, you're only going to succeed to the extent that other people know about you, what the issue is, who the bad guys are, how they can get involved. In order to do that, you have to propagate your message, whether it's online or through canvassers or through petitions. The technology is secondary. It is a force multiplier, because if you had all the money and all the people in the world, you could do anything. You could go off and buy media outlets. But what we focus in on are the groups that have no money, no time, no skills, and very little staff. Let us show you how technology can help you reach more people with very little time and effort. And if we can do this, it makes them more successful and they have to waste less time on fundraising. And that's how we kind of fight back, because you can't outspend the big guys.
Right.
We have to work smarter.
Now, you're definitely not going to outspend the billionaires who we keep funding. And this is the part that drives me crazy. They're killing us with our own money. And they're beating us with our own revenues. So I guess the last line of questioning I've got for you, and it's for the Democrats, because I beat up on the Democrats because I hope they should know better. I know Republicans are going to do every nasty, horrible thing that they're going to do. My hope is that Democrats are better. So if you had, you know, Schumer's ear or Jeffrey's ear, what are you telling them about, you know, how do we reach people?
I would say take a page out of the Republicans' book, which is innovate, get smarter, and have messaging discipline, which is we need to be able to work smarter, not just raise more money and then waste it on TV ads. And for heaven's sake, like, you know, where people are motivated by how much they make out of a campaign, that's, you know, that's just terrible. We've got to innovate.
So are we in favor of campaign finance reform, caps, public funding? You know, are you in on any of that stuff, or is that someone else's deal?
That's way above my pay grade. But, you know, this thing about Citizens United, voter suppression, those are things which they've been kind of doing for years now, the Republicans. And so when that changes, I don't know. But the thing is, when people are being hurt, when they're losing their healthcare, when they're losing their food stamps, for heaven's sake, we need to kind of get people to pay attention to who's doing it, why they're doing it, and how they can get organized. And if in order to do that, it's going to be the, you know, the working people, like you said, the grassroots activists. And if we can help them in a small way to fight back harder using the right free technology tools, we will have served our purpose.
No, look, Deepak, I said on election night, and I've been saying ever since, The country has decided to go in this direction, and the solutions for the future are going to come from the suffering due to their savagery. That's been the line I've been using. Their savagery is apparent. You look at that bill they passed, you look at the cuts to Medicaid, food stamps, on down, there will be true suffering, and there will be pain, and not just for the liberals and not just for Democrats, but for everyone in this country. And for me, the organizing that has to be done right now to bring those people in, to get us to the solutions we need down the road, what you do, I think, is incredibly important. So keep up the great work. I hope folks will check out the demlabs.org. We'll get links out on social media. But Deepak, I appreciate the time. Great work. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Rick.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Something you might be interested in, something you might want to organize around, something you might, I don't know, spend a little time on the internet talking to friends, neighbors. Want to hear your thoughts? rick@therickssmithshow.com. Right back after this.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO. Connecting audiences, powering brands. This is Civic Media. Learn more at civicmedia.us/advertise.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny and highs in the mid-80s. Tonight, mostly clear, upper 60s. Sunny, hot, and humid for Sunday. Highs in the low 90s. The heat index will push near 100. Sunday night, chance of showers and thunderstorms in low 70s.
Currently, 83 degrees.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
At age 30, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, you can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I saw a phrase the other day that grabbed my attention. The idea that not a single person, one person, should never have the ability to destroy the planet. One person shouldn't have the power to drop the nuke, so to speak. We got a president who, he gets the urge, he gets the itch. He's already talked about, nuking hurricanes. If the Epstein files, if things like that get too hard, who knows what he's pressing? Or, during the Reagan years, we were always concerned that Reagan might, forget that it wasn't, a call for ice cream and it was a nuclear bomb. And here to share some thoughts on maybe how we fix that, and maybe how we, in this age of rising tensions, kind of tap things down a bit. That's why I've asked Marty Perlmutter to come share some thoughts with us. Marty is the executive director of the Nuclear Disarmament Renewal at the Carpenter Institute for Progressive Democrats of America, nukewise.org, the website. Marty, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure, Rick. So
that is quite a mouthful. Quite a mouthful indeed.
Let's shorten that. Let's tighten it up.
Absolutely. So let's start with some basic stuff. What is the Nuclear Disarmament and Renewal Project there you're working on? And who's the Carpenter Institute of Progressive Democrats of America? Give me some basic stuff.
PDA is the reason we all know the name Sanders. They put him on the map. And progressive Democrats do amazing things that concern all of us as, working Americans. They have a educational 501c3 nonprofit that's nonpartisan, and its purpose is civic education. And the Carpenter Institute is an homage to the gentleman who founded PDA over a decade ago. And I'm honored to be running or initiating, we're giving birth to this thing, an organization that will put life back into the nuclear field, including information and policy advocacy and organizing.
Yeah, see, Marty, when I was a kid, this was a big deal. There was a lot of talker. There's a lot of energy around this last several years. Not so much, especially since Putin invaded Ukraine, the message has been just the opposite, not disarmament, but ramping up, because, you know, Putin showed that when you give up your nukes, some big behemoth's going to come in and take your cookies or your country. So the messaging has been kind of on the other side of this. So do you see that as problematic or a reason to ramp this up?
Well, good question, Rick. So Ukraine had 4,000 nukes in the early 90s. They gave them up for a promise of respect for their territorial integrity and sovereignty. Oops. And the 4,000 nukes went back to Russia. Many of them got turned into diluted nuclear fuel, and others just got chopped up. The lesson is not lost on many countries, including South Korea, Japan, Germany, Poland, the United Arab Emirates, think of them as a nuclear power, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, South Africa, which once had nukes. There are many countries that are standing in line, scratching their heads, Lithuania, you know, saying, hey, what happens if you don't have these things? But the world is really quite different than it was when you and I were coming up. And we've had nukes for 80 years, here's one fact that we could all look at. The United States today, could disarm Russia and China both at the same time using non-nuclear weapons, using stealth technologies that we have and delivery systems that we possess, and they know it. So wait a minute, what am I saying? I'm saying that we don't need nukes to do the really serious stuff at this moment. And what does that mean? Nukes have become the weapons of the weak. North Korea, weak. Russia, at the moment, manifestly weak. China panicked about having non-parity, you know, under Mao Zedong. They only had 150 nukes. Now they're going to build 1,500 so that they have parity with the United States and Russia, and that'll create some interesting problems. Shortening this, deterrence seems to remain a fact. If somebody has nukes, it's unlikely that anybody's going to go right after them. On the other hand, they're militarily of very limited value, as is pretty evident from what's happened in Ukraine, right? So why do we have them? There are two classes of use of nuclear weapons that we talk about. Counterforce, which is when we bomb the Russian missile fields with nukes, and countervalue. Now, what does countervalue mean? That means holding populations hostage. And is that, like, okay? No, it's not okay. It's not okay ethically. It's not okay militarily. It's just a mutual assured destruction terror weapon. And my position that I'm suggesting to you is that the really sophisticated people who are looking at this stuff are scratching their heads and saying, why do we have these things?
Yeah. No, I mean, because you hit on a phrase that, you know, was my childhood, mutual assured destruction, mad, you know, we got to have this because they're ramping up, we have to ramp up so that they won't go first because it'll be, you know, the end for both of us. And there was an understanding of that. You're right. We don't live in that Cold War world anymore. And it's interesting that you bring up that we don't need them. Because for the average person, and look, I'm going to throw myself in the middle of that. I would rather have them than not, because if you've got them, I certainly want to be able to protect myself and us. Make that argument, you know, of why it's okay for us to maybe tap down or do away with again. Because I don't think people quite got that.
Okay, so Rick, you brought up the very first thing you said was sole authority. This is the putative power of the president alone to authorize the use of nuclear weapons. It has to be carried out. I mean, the president doesn't hit the button. What happens is a command is given to the strategic authorities, and the strategic weapons people further send the message down. It goes about five iterations down. Then somebody in a silo or in a submarine hits a button, and a whole bunch of permission links have to be synchronized in order to do this. It must be a lawful order. You can't say, it's Tuesday and Melania and I had a terrible fight, let's obliterate Isfahan in Iran. You can't do that. That's not allowed. I know we are in a phase where it seems that the law doesn't matter, but to military people, the law matters a lot, a lot. So sole authority, that's one thing. And then there's a variety of other layers of thinking that need to be updated, you know, and obviously sole authority should be gotten rid of. because it's ridiculous and it's a leftover from a time when there was no ability to communicate instantaneously, you know, using my cell phone. I could talk to everybody in Congress in 4 seconds and say, hey, should we blow the world up or not? So we could get rid of sole authority. First use, which is an American policy still, a leftover, real leftover of the 1960s, you know, which we needed, we thought, because the Russians had 5,000 tanks and we had 1,000 in Germany. And we were worried about the Russian tanks rolling through the so-called Fulda Gap into Bonn. And we said, okay, we're going to let you know, and we're going to have a policy that says that we can be the first to use nuclear weapons before anybody else does. Well, why do we have that now? And by the way, there is at this moment in time, one nuclear agreement in operation between the United States and Russia. It will time out next February, and then there'll be none. We have no negotiations or discussions with the Chinese. The Chinese have said, if you declare a policy of no first use, meaning we won't, the United States won't be the first to use nuclear weapons, we'll sit down with you and talk about our 1,550 nukes that we're building right now to put into those silos that we've dug in the Xinjiang desert. I think that would be a really nice thing to do. And if we had a policy of no first use, then I don't have to freak out about sole authority because I don't have to worry about Melania pissing off Don and us having a nuclear war on Tuesday.
Right. But, you know, here's the thing, and this is where my mind goes. Given this administration, given the people who control Congress, the Senate, the House, I have no faith that this is even something that they would consider, even with overwhelming popular support.
Absolutely correct. You're right. You're absolutely right. So here's what we're going to do. And this is why PDA and the Carpenter Institute and my efforts on their behalf may bear fruit, and where we could use some intelligence from the audience here. And it's this: we're going to organize the best academic thinkers. We're going to talk to the best military and government figures in national security. And we're going to use the organizing ability, the manifest significant organizing ability of PDA, to reach millions of people and educate them. A little bit, like nukewise.org, that site is intended for Gen Z people to look at and wake up about the details of nuclear weapons, educate people to these issues, and then begin to mobilize them. This is not going to happen in 15 minutes, but it will happen in less than 15 months. We'll have people's attention. And in 15 months, we might have the beginnings of, well, a bit over 15 months, a different administration in terms of what's happening in Congress and certainly in the House. And then we can begin to talk about logical, sensible changes we could consider in our nuclear policies. And there are three or four things that we could go for. Get rid of the first use thing so we can talk to the Chinese. Rethink nuclear modernization, spending trillions of dollars. Even Trump agrees with this. It's stupid. The amount of money that is involved in modernizing nuclear weapons and sticking them on top of 50-year-old missiles inside those Minuteman, you know, silos, that's demented. Rethink whether we need three legs of our nuclear triad. I understand why that works out for Boeing and Raytheon and, you know, the other major defense contractors, but I don't see it necessary for the United States of America's right. Security.
And the third one?
Well, not modernize and get rid of the ground-based nuclear deterrent. Why the heck do we have that? And wouldn't that be an amazing thing? Just imagine Donald Trump, who wants the Nobel Prize, saunters up to the podium in 2 years at the United Nations in September, when all the world leaders gather, and says the United States today wishes to unilaterally declare that it's about to dismantle its ground-based nuclear forces. We're not asking anybody to do anything. We are, we hope, going to get some reciprocity by others, but hey, do what you want to do. We have over 700 thermonuclear weapons on our submarines that are still undetectable at any time, so we don't have to worry about our crappy missiles in the ground in Montana, and we're getting rid of them.
And then Marty Perlmutter would be the guy who would put Trump up for the Nobel Prize? Is that how that works?
You know what? If he did that and had a deal with the Chinese that we don't have now and renewed with Russia, I will go to Norway to be present and to applaud.
All right. But here's the thing, and this is where, as you were talking about this, I go, the military-industrial complex, they're going to lose their freaking minds, Marty.
No, they don't need to, because we need, you know, those Patriot missiles, those things. Each one of the missiles themselves is $1 million. The unit costs $1 billion. The Germans just 2 days ago announced they're going to send 5 of their Patriot systems to Ukraine, which is terrific because Zelensky needs 10 total. Norway has said they were going to send one. I think the Dutch should send one. The French will send 2, and boom, Zelensky's got his dream. Then he can shoot down those Zinzhal missiles, the supposedly hypersonic pieces of crap that rarely get through even now. He'll have enough Patriots to do it. That's going to still take a lot of money. And the Europeans have this thing going on where they're buying the stuff from American suppliers and then giving it to the Ukrainians. That's a workable system. We can live with that. And this war can be fought to a good defensive climax using that system. So, hey, if I'm Raytheon and I'm selling those Patriot, you know, resupply missiles at $1 million a piece, I'm a happy guy.
You're making your business. So then let me get to this, because, you know, most of the people that I know who are on the, you know, the getting rid of nukes bandwagon are also the anti-war folks. It doesn't sound like you're in that world. So how do you bring...
How do you square that?
How do you square that?
Look, I mean, war sucks. Come on. I mean, it's hideous. On the other hand, when Sherman said war is hell, what did he mean? He's not a poetic guy. He wasn't making some silly little observation. What he meant, and when he clarified this, is that war, when it is not prosecuted as hell, meaning if you don't press hard, and he burned his way across Georgia, then what happens is the war continues. Talk to the Israelis about how well that's worked out in Gaza. The war goes on, and more people die over time. You hit hard, you hit fast, and you end it quickly. War is hell. I don't advocate it, but when you're in it, there's a certain way to prosecute it.
No, I agreed with the Powell Doctrine. I agreed with, you know, you go in with overwhelming force, you try and make it as short as possible to attain your mission, your end goal. The important part is having an end goal, and that's
strategy. I mean, that's strategy. And, you know, here's the thing. I mean, this, you actually brought this up from the very beginning. We haven't had an end goal thinking, strategically for a long, long time in our nuclear posture and our nuclear strategy. You know, we just haven't thought about it. And I haven't seen an integration of the thinking about precision weapons and, robotic weapons and force delivered without reliance on, you know, these gross terror weapons, you know, which are not necessary. I mean, it's a hideous thing to say, but the United States can kill anybody on planet Earth within 3 hours, no matter where they are, no matter how deep the hole they're in. You know, ask Vlad the Impaler, ask Mr. Putin if that's not true. He'll tell you, yeah, they could. They really could.
But, you know, I listened to you, Marty, and sane, logical, rational. This is the kind of messaging that I want to hear around this issue. Because, look, I don't want to pass down to future generations the nightmare that we grew up in and worrying about the end of days and having to hide under Catholic school desks because we were told that's what saved us from the fallout of nuclear winter. I want to pass on something worth inheriting. So to hear that kind of rational positioning that you've got, I think could encourage a lot of people to come to your group to get around this issue. So if someone's out there going, hey, I like what Marty said, is there a way to get involved with what you're doing? Does your group, are you an organizing group? What do you do?
Yes, so through PDA, through Progressive Democrats of America, we'll have a website, a new website. I mean, you can communicate with me directly through that nukewise.org site, but through this new site that's coming soon, you'll be able to communicate with us, to give us ideas, to indicate support, to give financial support. Modest, small amounts of money will go a long way in this domain. And to become engaged. And reciprocally, we're going to have all kinds of webinars, communications, media, you know, information about the area so that people get smart, quick about, you know, about nukes. Look, nobody wants to think about this stuff. And that's the problem. And it can kill us. You know, one nuke can ruin an entire weekend. And we need to get people re-engaged. I mean, noodling about what is this stuff? And why have we let it, you know, just wander for 80 years? And what are our options now? It's a very, very different world than it was in 1945. You know, and you know, what we ought to do. I mean, should we spend a couple of $1 trillion modernizing our ground-based nuclear deterrent in those holes in Montana and North Dakota? Maybe that's really stupid. Maybe that's really stupid. Yeah. And the military industrial folks who we have to, you know, deal with, we have to, it's a real thing. They have plenty of toys that they can make that we need. And they'll be able to make their money without doing something that actually is turning out to be extremely difficult for them to do. In South Carolina, there's a plant where they're building pits. They're about this big. That's the core of the thermonuclear weapon, right? They've spent $9 billion on this plant so far. It's not functioning properly, right? And this is to modernize, to rebuild those nukes. We test those things. You know, not we don't blow them up anymore. You don't need to use supercomputers to do this stuff. But there are ways that we have of verifying the utility of what we got without doing awful stuff and without violating. There is a treaty, there are two treaties that exist still beyond what we have with Russia. There's the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is about to go down the toilet because there are going to be 8 new nuclear powers in 5 years. And there's an agreement not to test in the air that everybody but North Korea honors. We don't need to test anything, and we sure as hell don't need to modernize our ground-based nuclear deterrent.
Especially at a time when we're cutting SNAP programs and Medicaid and doing the anti-Jesus work. But Marty, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Great discussion. Hope folks will check out the website, nukewise.org. Marty Perlmutter, thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Bless you.
Great talking with you. I want to hear your thoughts. Is this an issue that resonates? I know, look, when I go back to when I was a kid, this was kind of the big deal. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1898. That was the day that the United States Armed Forces invaded Puerto Rico. The invasion was part of the Spanish-American War. In 1898, the U.S. State Department noted, quote, "It seems to be conceded that every year we shall be confronted with an increasing surplus of manufactured goods for sale in foreign markets if American operatives and artisans are to be kept employed year-round." Many business leaders in the U.S. clamored for market expansion. At the time, Spain was still a colonial presence in the Caribbean and Pacific. When a revolution in Cuba sought to drive out the Spanish, in the United States, the drumbeats for war began to boom. Many saw this as an opportunity to expand the U.S. sphere of influence, although some labor leaders warned against war. One official from the Longshoremen's Union warned working people, quote, "If there is a war, you will furnish the corpses and the taxes, and others will get the glory." But soon labor leaders, including the president of the American Federation of Labor, Samuel Gompers, got swept up in the war fever. In just a few months, the U.S. ousted the Spanish and became the colonial power in not only Puerto Rico, but also Guam and the Philippines, as well as Hawaii. This gave the United States footholds in the Caribbean and the Pacific. The small island of Puerto Rico remains a U.S. territory to this present day. Since the U.S. invasion, there have been movements for both Puerto Rican independence and also for full U.S. statehood. Today, the Puerto Rican people face a severe economic crisis, towering debt, and an unemployment rate more than double that of the United States. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, every time I think about what we just talked about with Marty, every time I think about, you know, war in general, or military spending and the enormous amount of money we spend on military, I think about Eisenhower. I think about the Eisenhower quotes that I learned about, you know, growing up, and the fact that, you know, as Eisenhower said, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. The world, he said, in arms is not spending money alone. It's spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. He said, this is not a way of life at all in any true sense. He said, under the cloud of war, it is humanity hanging on an iron cross. And in that same vein of humanity hanging from an iron cross, he goes on and enumerates making one heavy bomber meant sacrificing 30 modern schools or two fully equipped hospitals or two electric power plants. He says, we pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed 8,000 people. He said, this is not a way of life in any true sense under the threat of the cloud of the threat of war. And to me, that's the reality. It's that opportunity cost. We're spending enormous sums of money on things that, I don't know, do we need to blow up the world 100 times? Wouldn't just one be enough? Because we can do it. And as Marty pointed out, we've got other capacities. Now, you may remember back in July, July 24th it was, the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, they put out a report. Turns out we're now 7 years away from Social Security and Medicare running out of cash. And that means in 7 years, the benefit cuts will be 24% across the board, or nearly $18,100 a year for a retired couple. It's going to be me. And that's, you know, 2033. So we're just right around the corner. And for healthcare, Medicare, there's going to be another 11% cut coming. So this is real folks getting really screwed. So when you look at the money that we could be spending on all this other stuff, you know, we gave billionaires their money. Do we have to keep spending it? And understand, this was stuff that we worked for, we earned, and they're taking it after decades of people working their tail off. And yet now we've got some working class, some Trump supporters who are, you know, still cheering on those politicians who pushed through that one big, beautiful nightmare that's going to make slashing Social Security happen faster. And again, expanding giveaways to the very wealthy. I find it interesting that people are waving the flag and cheering on the cuts to those people while retirement security for millions of people is being stolen right out from under them. And how does that make any sense? I mean, I think about my Republican friends who voted for this, knew this was what this was going to be. Supported basically cutting your own throat because of they're going to go after someone else. We voted for policies that are going to make poor people worse off while ensuring that the trust fund babies, they are able to load their coffers easier. The wealthy keep getting huge tax breaks, more loopholes, and well, the rest of us, not so much. And I think back to Trump, all the promises about keeping Social Security safe. Yeah, they were empty words then, and they're even more now. So if you're a working person cheering on the nonsense that's coming out of Trump world, ask yourself why you're betting against your own future. The cuts just don't hurt the rich because, understand, they don't care about Social Security. They don't want Social Security. But retirees, people who are going into their golden years who need that, who planned on it, planned on the Medicare that's going to be part of that, the medicine they're going to have to buy, this is not good. This is not good for any of us. But again, we look at the policies that come out of D.C. We look at the policies that come out of our elected officials. We've got no problem giving trillions of dollars to the very wealthy. No problem giving trillions of dollars to the military-industrial complex. No problem giving trillions of dollars to those who already have trillions of dollars. And yet we're going to go after single moms, food stamps, Medicaid, and that what's left of our tattered social safety net. Seems like something wrong with that picture. Something very, very wrong in my view. In the most powerful country in the history of humanity, the wealthiest country in the history of humanity, I think we can do better, don't you? We should be demanding better. I know that. I want to hear your thoughts email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do you think this is right? Do you think it's sane, rational? Anything you heard today you want to get involved with? I want to hear your thoughts, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you will find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio.
WXCO 1230 AM, W255DN Wausau.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Allison Keyes. Passengers on a Southwest flight are thankful after pilots sent the aircraft into a 300-foot dive to avoid a collision with a nearby plane. KCAL reporter Hunter Sowers with details.
Southwest Airlines said in part, the crew of Southwest Flight 1496 responded to two onboard traffic alerts while climbing out of Burbank, California, requiring them to climb and descend to comply with the alerts. That warning is known as a collision avoidance alert, protecting against mid-air crashes. Two flight attendants were treated for injuries when the plane touched down in Vegas.
President Trump is in Scotland, but questions over his association with the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein are continuing to swirl after Epstein accomplice Ghislaine Maxwell met twice with the number two official at the Justice Department. CBS's Erica Brown.
Maxwell's attorney says she cooperated with the Justice Department, answering every question.